Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow, Richard! Imagine I said a culturally relevant reference to the butterfly effect to kick off our episode.
What a great reference to kick off our episode, OJ.
But I can't, because this movie has no cultural footprint, really. So I feel like there's nothing.
This is, Ashton, this is like the Kutcher's Avatar in the news. Of film.
Yeah, I mean, other than Ashton Kutcher being relevant again for all the wrong, but I bet he wishes he could bloody go back in time and butterfly effect his own life at the moment. Welcome along,
everybody. Do you reckon if Ashton
Kutcher
could go back in time, he would stop himself writing that letter, or he would stop Danny Masterton from doing what he did?
Yeah, exactly. Probably the first one.
I reckon he would, too, because it's like, if you go back and stop all the Danny Masterton stuff, you're just like, you're changing too much.
It's like changing 9/11 this far on.
Yeah.
Or killing Hitler. It's like, it'd be too much admin to keep up with all the historical changes if I went back in time and killed Hitler. I don't have time.
Fun start to the podcast. Anyway.
Welcome along to Film Franchise Fortnights on the Cold Popch Podcast, where myself, AJ, and my God, beautiful best friend Richard. God, he's so attractive.
Thank you. I haven't been feeling very beautiful lately, so I needed to hear that. I have the driest skin under my eyes. If anyone out there can help me with this
and moisturize your eyeballs a little more.
Well, this is the thing. Like, I've never had, like, it's like almost like eczema, but like, I've never had that before, especially not under my eyes. I don't know.
It's called being in your 30s, mate. Yeah. Sorry about it. This is a
I'm
show
older
where,
than you.
Yeah, by like 4 months.
Yeah, but it's not like you can't be like,
me.
Welcome to your 30s, mate. Because like,
welcome
I,
to the party,
I welcome
pal.
You to your 30s.
And I'm welcoming you back. So the Film Franchise Fortnights on the Cop Option Podcast, where we watch and discuss a different film franchise every fortnight. And as the fates would have it, This fortnight, for what wasn't supposed to be Spooktober, but we're now stretching the parameters of whatever genre the butterfly effect is to be like, yeah, it's a Halloween episode. we're covering the Butterfly Effect trilogy. Now, depending on your upbringing, you might have one of two questions. Either, are there sequels to the Butterfly Effect, or what's the Butterfly Effect? Because I reckon this has got to be one of the more obscure franchises we've ever done. I reckon.
In a certain manner of speaking.
I reckon there's so many people who don't know a fucking thing about this trilogy. The Butterfly Effect came out, the first one came out in 2004. The second one, The Butterfly Effect 2, came out in 2006. With the third one, The Butterfly Effect Revelations, came out in 2009. The last two were straight to DVD. The first one, I think, had a theatrical run.
Straight
and
to
was,
cinemas.
It was a mainstay of the $10 DVD bargain bin.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that kind of film.
Late 2000s.
Plays on TV all the time. You'd get it out because it's like kind of adult, but not really. Like it's a lot of one of those, like, it's the first movie, you know, of this kind that you watch. The first psychological thriller that you ever see.
Yeah. So, came out in 2004, directed by Eric Bress and J. Mackey Gruber.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
who are the writers of Final Destination 2.
Which Bress also wrote. Very similar to that, yeah.
Yep, Bress also wrote Final Destination, the Final Destination, the worst one. And both are the creators of the TV show Kyle XY, which if
really?
You've seen is very different to the Butterfly Effect.
I looked up these guys to see what else they'd done, and I didn't come across the Kyle XY thing. That's interesting.
Mm.
I didn't read, no. I just looked at their filmography. And they don't have a lot of other films.
No. And maybe the most important piece of information we can preface this episode with to sort of really drive home what kind of movies these are is the disparity between the critic score on Rotten Tomatoes and the audience score. Yes. So I would like you to guess both of these, please.
I would guess the audience score is like mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would guess the critic score is like 40.
You're just off. We've got a critic score of 34% and an audience score of 81%. Oof. Oh, you don't see this often.
The critics put out the hit for the Butterfly Effect.
what are
fans of the Butterfly Effect call themselves?
Butterflies.
Yeah, I guess.
Hmm.
What they is it about?
friends of Evan. The main character of the Butterfly.
Evan Treborn, one of the worst main character names I've ever heard. Like, straight up. And it's one of those things that, like, you know, you've talked about, like, why do I still remember the name Larry Daly from Night at the Museum? It's like, I've always known Evan Treborn's name because it's, like, you know, if you'd asked me at any point in the last, you know, since I first saw this movie when I was probably 12 or 13, I would be able to tell you his name is Evan Treborn, because those writers, they thought they were being so clever, and his name is Event Reborn because he can do events again.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
That's really funny that you didn't pick up on that.
That's the smartest thing about this movie.
It's the dumbest thing about this movie, yeah. Evan Treborn. I hate Evan Treborn as a name because it's what I would have thought of.
Yeah.
At that age, if I was doing like, you know, for film class, doing like a time travel movie, it's so stupid. Anyway, so Evan Treborn, the film starts with like sort of a greatest hits of his trauma, and so you see
about half an hour before Kutcher appears as the character.
You see all these little pieces in his life, and he's prone to these blackouts, and so sort of the biggest turning points in his life he's not actually like psychologically present for. And then,
and let's just put this here, content warning for a bunch of shit that just did not need to be explored in these movies. we're talking sexual assault, child molestation, that sort of shit is going to be part of this discussion. So if that triggers you, I assure you guys, this is not a good enough franchise to stick around listening to if you struggle with that, with hearing people talk about this. We're not going to joke about it. It's just that, you know, it needs to be discussed. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, when we get to part of his treatment for this is to write diaries detailing what happened, and then, you know, that might be able to help him remember some of the blackouts. And then cut to, he's now in college. He's, I think, 24, he's supposed to be, or something like that. It's quite young, right. Younger than Ashton Kutcher looks. And he finds these diaries again. He starts to read one of them. And then he time travels back to where he, the blackout.
Blew up a baby. He blew up a baby with dynamite.
Yeah. And so he just observes it this time, but then he realizes, oh shit, I can go back and right some of the wrongs from my past. And so each time he goes back, he returns to modern day in a completely different universe, essentially multiverse. It's like, this is very much like a precursor to the multiverse of films, I think. But he,
well, this is what the titular butterfly effect refers to, is the chaos theory idea
which you would think would be the big glue that holds the three films together. But no, we'll get to that later on. But yeah, you're saying the chaos theory idea that...
The chaos theory, the idea that, that the flap of a butterfly's wings can be...
Can cause a tsunami on the other side of the world.
Yeah, exactly. So domino if you go effect, back sort of and, stuff, yeah. and stop something small like getting molested by your girlfriend's
blowing
dad,
up a baby with dynamite.
Or blowing up a baby with dynamite, then you may wake up in the
with
nightmarish
no
reality where you're a frat boy or you have no arms. Yeah,
so one of them is a frat boy, one of them has no arms. There's a bunch of them where he doesn't know people, or he's got this core group of friends. He's got the girl that he was in love with since he was a little kid, and then her brother, who was like a psychopath, and then their friend as well, who is so traumatized by blowing up a baby with dynamite that he becomes essentially catatonic in a lot of these realities. And so, yeah, yada yada, he keeps going back and forth trying to change things, and then, oh, you know, my life seems perfect now, or it's so horrible. And so he goes back and keeps trying to change things, and the idea that every time he goes back and he changes something, it has a massive effect on the future, and he keeps going back to each of the times he blacks out. So it's important to note as well that, like, each time he comes back, he gets, like, a fucking brain hemorrhage, which is, you know, the missing memories being shoved into his brain. So he's able to adjust to the new realities, like, a bit quicker than you sort of normally would, because it's like he does have the memories of the last 10...
In real life.
Yeah. And and then the film ends with he goes back in time to... one event.
He stops the baby being blown up, which knocks off his arms, so he never got to write his diaries.
Yeah.
And so can't travel back in time anymore.
Yeah, but then he goes back in time and accident after that, because he manages to go back to a diary entry from before his arms got blown up, and accidentally kills Kaylee, which means he got institutionalized, which means he was never able to write the diaries. And so he goes back one last time, and if you're watching the film now, pretty much only the director's cut is available, but I'll tell you the theatrical ending first.
I've got them written down.
Oh yeah, I've seen both, but so the theatrical ending of the film is that while he's in this institution, and they're like, look, Evan, we've talked about this. This is all a figment of your imagination. You got the idea that you're able to travel back in time. And he travels back in time one last time to the birthday party where he first meets Kaylee, and he says, hey, look, who's Amy Smart's character, the love of his life. And he says, hey, look, if you ever come near me again, I'm going to fucking kill your whole family. And she's like, runs off and is like, oh man, I'm so scared of this kid. And that means that she goes to live with her mother, and then most of, you know, these horrible events of Evan's life never happened, because a lot of them revolved around her and her family. She only stayed to live with her pedophile father because she wanted to stay near Evan. And they have their lives going completely different directions. And at the very end of the film, he's years later, he's some kind of business guy in New York City, and he walks past Kaylee. They share a look, but keep on walking in opposite directions. And then there's a few different versions of that. One, they stop and he's like, oh, hey, Kaylee, right? And she's like, what? And he's like, yo, you just look like a Kaylee. And he buys her a drink and they live happily ever after. And then there's one where they share a look and then he turns around and follows her. But the ending that's like...
learning nothing, presumably.
Exactly. But the ending that, if you download the film now or like buy the DVD, this is like the default ending on the DVD, which I got 5 minutes into the film and remembered, oh, I have this on DVD, I can watch it on that. in this one, it's all the same up until the point. There's one added scene to make this ending work earlier on. But he, instead of watching a home movie of this birthday party, he watches a home movie of his own birth, and he goes back in time to when he was in the womb, and he wraps his umbilical cord around himself, giving his mother her either third or fourth stillbirth in a row.
Fourth stillborn in a row.
But the thing is, earlier in the film,
her previous children did the same thing. Could butterfly effect.
But then the same, earlier in the film, she says she had two stillborns in a row. And then at the end of the film, when it flashes back in his mind while this is happening to remind the audience of it, she says three.
I wonder, is that a goof? Is that a mistake? Interesting. I think so. I did notice that as well.
But the
I've noticed that every time I've watched it, but it's not until now that I've realized I'm not just misremembering.
That two and three are
time.
Different numbers.
Yeah, yeah. I thought they were the same number, Richard.
But it is, yeah, because also he realizes and that he's like, oh man, my mum has cancer because of all the time travel.
Because,
I don't know.
Because she started chain smoking because of the last thing. Because he blew his arms off, she started chain smoking and now has cancer. And so he's like, I know, I'll do her a favor. I'll go back in time and give her third or fourth stillborn baby in a row. Oh, yeah. That'll fix things. That'll make my mother feel better.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just saying, like, if I was a mother and I was dying of cancer and I'm in my 50s, presumably, right? I would rather that and still have my son, whom I adore, than have lived a full life without him, you know?
Yeah. Well, the director's cut ending is very edgy and, like, I saw on Reddit and stuff like that a bunch of people saying, like, did you know there's an alternate ending where he strangles himself? But I had only ever seen that version.
Yeah, because, same. Yeah.
And then I found out, oh, there was an original ending. And I think the original ending is so much better. It's like, it's a lot better, the idea of like, Kaylee is better off without me in her life, rather than one of these films that has the message of, you are a burden to everyone, kill yourself.
It is a repugnant message to put in a film.
Yeah.
And insane that it made it all this way. Insane that it, I don't think you could do this ending now. I think writers are too self-aware
you can't say
of the,
these days.
Well, you can't say any. You can't even say fuck, Richard, without the bloody woke police wanting to butterfly effect your fucking birth. You know? Like, you got. So I think that. I think that there is no good ending to the butterfly effect. I think both endings are bad. Mm. We'll get into this a little bit after we discuss the endings. But when I first saw this movie, I saw the strangulation in the womb ending. And I thought, great ending. I was 12 years old, great ending, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Then years later, I watched this ending where he goes back in time and tells little Kaylee, if you come near me, I'll kill you and your family. And here's the problem with that ending is that I don't think it's particularly exciting. What the womb strangulation ending has over that ending is that it's a dramatic gesture. It's a piece of action. It's doing something. It's quite high stakes. And I think on paper, that's a better ending. And I don't think scaring a little girl is particularly high stakes.
I disagree. I mean, I think that, you're right. The actual action that he goes back in time and does is obviously a lot bigger when he strangles himself in utero, but I think that the seeing Kaylee's life without Evan in it is the climax, not the scaring a little kid. I think that that's your big cinematic climax, is the flashes we get of everything that, you know, fits in with the story we've had up until now.
I see what you're saying. Okay, well, Richard, we've gotten pretty far into this episode without discussing a fairly important and crucial piece of the puzzle for our discussion around this movie anyway. Because in case listeners, if you couldn't tell, we're speaking quite negatively and making fun of this movie a lot. All of this being said, all of my distaste for this movie still standing, this is one of the most important films I've ever seen in my life. This film, when I saw this film when I was 12, let me paint the picture. Let us do the cult popturian. Here's what happened when I first saw this film.
Well, I do edit these podcasts now, so you can keep it tight.
We used to have family movie nights every Saturday, right?
Mm-hmm.
We would get out all sorts of movies that you wouldn't think a 12-year-old should be watching, right? Including one night we got out The Butterfly Effect. It begins. 5 minutes in, you get to a whopper of a child molestation scene. And my dad just said, no, we're not watching this. Turn it off. The movie gets shut off, right? Years later, I must have been like 10. Because years later, when I was 12 or 13, my brother saw it and was like, Alex, I've seen The Butterfly Effect. You have to watch the whole thing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Watched it and I was like, this is mature film. This is what mature adults watch.
Yeah.
You know, adults
your first
watch,
adult film you watched.
Yeah. Mature adults watch films with like
Ashton Kutcher.
Horror. Ashton Kutcher and horrible child molestation scenes, and scenes where babies get blown up with dynamite, and scenes where someone gets raped in prison. Like, adult movies rape their protagonists. You know, these are the things I believed. Like, this is hard.
And you look at the films
cinema.
That you made around that time, and all of those things are prison.
And I just thought this was, and like I told all my friends to watch it. Like,
you're like, you've got
to
watch it. He gets raped in prison.
I watched it. Like, I was gravitated to.
A dog gets burnt alive.
Yeah. I was gravitated to similar films, like we just discussed on a Patreon episode we just recorded. The number 23 is very much holds hands with the butterfly effect. The Adrian Brody movie, The Jacket, was another one that I cannot remember what it is, but I remember thinking this is my favorite movie because it's like The Butterfly Effect. This movie influenced what I would write. I remember being 14 and trying to write a novel that was essentially, Richard, The Butterfly Effect, and all, you know, not in concept, but in very much in tone. And like, it was just such a, I just felt like it was such a groundbreaking and interesting and great movie. And as I started to get older, I started realizing how frustrated I was getting with the endings. And then eventually got to the point where I was like, I must have seen it again and just been like, this movie sucks. Like, this is so bad. This movie is so poorly made. A lot of the criticism that I was looking up, like the Rotten Tomatoes critical consensus and all the like Roger Ebert reviews and stuff, they talk about how tasteless the film is. And I think that's so apt. That, and when I was 12, as I said, I thought depictions of animal abuse and prison rape were these mature, dark things that you have to be mature enough to handle watching in a film. But now it all feels like these edgy filmmakers are like, yeah, and then he kills his dog, and then he gets raped in prison. And it's you know what I mean? Like, that's the attitude. The attitude behind it is not like, oh, I feel so compelled to tell the story that I'm willing to take it to some very dark places. You hear about who's the guy that wrote Lolita? He like wanted to. Tried to destroy the manuscript several times because he was so disgusted with what he was writing. You know, I watched a 17-minute The Making of the Butterfly Effect special feature the other day, which, by the way, let's bring special features back. What an aesthetic. What a vibe.
Fuck yeah. Those are. I should pop in the DVD and have a look.
Yeah, and the directors, Eric Bress and J. Mackey Gruber, they just come across as the biggest fucking edgelord losers.
Really?
Like, yeah. It's so funny and so embarrassing to hear them and Kutcher and Eric Stoltz, who plays the pedophile dad. Like, all of these people are being interviewed in this little behind-the-scenes featurette, and they're all speaking like they've made the next, like, fucking Chinatown or something. Yeah, you know? Like this real hard, going, but like a Clockwork Orange almost, you know. like you know,
it's
we
like,
have
sorry,
to show
snowflakes.
Sorry snowflakes, but this is drama.
This is the kind of films adults watch.
Yeah, and but they just come across as such fucking pathetic, sad losers. Yeah. And I felt so bad watching it because they talk about it like they're like, oh, we wrote this script and it got shopped around Hollywood and people wanted to buy it from us. And we were like, no, we have to direct. They got the Final Destination 2 writing job because of the script. Like, they'd already written The Butterfly Effect and then because of that wrote Final Destination 2. And that's what gave them the like clout to be able to direct their own film, basically. And like, yeah, it's like the way they talk about it, like this idea was beamed into their collective brains from heaven above as like the ultimate drama, the psychological thriller of 2004. And it got 34% on Rotten Tomatoes. Yeah. And they're absolutely the kind of guys who would have been crushed by this reception.
Probably listen to this podcast.
Yeah. They'll hate it.
My history of this film, I think this is one of those films that, like, my sister being a couple years older than me, like, got into this film and, like, was that sort of like, oh, you know, this is like an adult. And so after a couple of years, I was able to watch it too. And, like, you know, it was maybe a bit more adult than I should have been watching at the time. But loved this film, thought it was similar sort of experience that it's like, wow, you know, the first, like, real grown-up
and opened my eyes to cinema. And legitimately, the things I'm interested in now and the stories I'm compelled to now, in terms of talking about The Butterfly Effect, if you went back in time, stop me from ever watching this, I don't know if I would be into the stuff I'm into now. The stuff I'm into now is much better than The Butterfly Effect.
The stuff you're into now is like Killing Dogs, Prison
Break. No. I more mean like the genres I'm into now, you can trace all these back to The Butterfly Effect. Yeah. They're just much better executions of things like The Butterfly Effect.
And the thing is, so the interesting thing about this film is that I've known for a long time this is a don't rewatch it movie because it doesn't hold up. Mm-hmm. The last time I watched this movie before the podcast would have been 10, 15 years ago, and I still thought, I still liked it when I watched it last. Like, I was still in that zone, but I've just, like, being able to think about it, because I remember it fairly well. It's not like a, you know, back of my mind sort of film.
I watched this at so many sleepovers. I had the DVD. Yeah. I saw this 100 times.
Yeah, as a exactly. And I, watching it now, not going into it knowing that I'm about to watch a bad film this time, I wasn't crushed to find out. Part of me still loves this film and loved rewatching it, you know? Like, I thoroughly enjoyed watching it this time. And it's been funny, like, talking to people about, oh, I'm watching The Butterfly Effect films. And multiple people have been like, oh, the first one, like, I don't know there were sequels, but like, oh, The Butterfly Effect's really good, isn't it? And I go, rewatch it. See what you think.
Like, my flatmate was like, what franchise are you doing this Fortnite? And I was like, oh, I got to watch the Butterfly Effect trilogy. And she was like, oh, the first one's all right, isn't it? And I was like, no. Like, better than the sequels, sure. Yeah. But we are not talking about a good film here.
Yeah. But the thing is, like, you're talking about, you mentioned about this idea that, like, this idea for a film was, like, descended from the heavens and all stuff. That it's like, this is a film concept that has to exist. Like, it's a brilliant concept for a film. And I think that it's like, this is so close to being a great film. And that, like, there are the stuff that we latched onto as teenagers is still in there. There's just enough bad other stuff now, or some of it's recontextualized, that, like, as a 30-year-old, I could be like, no, this is bad. But yeah, like, there's so much stuff in this film that I'm still so fascinated by. And like you said, like, the idea, I've said this on the podcast before, but like, the idea of like paths not taken and things like that is just something that I not only like think about so much in my personal life, but I'm so fascinated by in media. And I think that, yeah, I mean, this is like The Butterfly Effect walked so that Everything Everywhere All at Once could run.
Yeah, sure, man. Like, absolutely.
They're, in a lot of ways, they're very similar films, and like,
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, I think that this really, I mean, you know, you could, if you made this now, people would say this is just capitalizing on Everything Everywhere All at Once, because it's like the frat boy persona where he ended up with the love of his life and like all these things. It's like, yeah, it's so multiverse coded.
Yeah. I would like to talk about some of the funniest bad stuff in this movie.
Yeah.
If we may. The stuff that really lets it down. Because despite the writers and directors saying, you know, acting like they were given this idea from Olympus on high itself, you know, this was Prometheus gave them the butterfly
effect. Stealing from the gods. The butterfly effect.
Despite that, it's also like not a very well thought out execution.
One of the most famous bad things about this film, and one of like, if we're talking about plot holes in film, this is like the poster boy for plot holes, because it is so specifically going against the logic already set up by the film. Like, the most important, the titular butterfly effect, that like this famous scene that goes against it. So he's in prison because he kills Tommy in his frat boy days. And
which, do you know where they filmed that?
Where?
An actual prison. And the extras are prisoners.
I think I did that. But yeah, it's like, it isn't that looks crazy? Like it. But one of the, his cellmate, who is
Kevin Durand
from Lost and X-Men Origins Wolverine.
Also Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed and Austin Powers. This is our fourth Kevin Durand franchise.
But yeah, he's, yeah, in in Mexican face, which is not great.
So much so that I only found out it was Kevin Durand when you messaged me this week saying, "Holy shit, that's Kevin Durand."
Yeah, but he anyway. So he's like, "I need help. I need protection from the gangs in prison. I need you to help me. I can travel through time. Here, I'm going to show you." So his cellmate is very religious, and he's like, "I'm going to travel back in time and give you a sign and show you what I can do." So he travels back in time to a time where he blacked out and drew this creepy picture. So he goes back in time, draws a creepy picture for seemingly no reason.
It's a picture of him having murdered the gang, right? And the first scene of the movie is the teacher pulling aside Evan's mum and being like, "He drew this creepy picture and doesn't remember drawing it."
Oh, yeah.
And it sets up this mystery. This isn't the plot hole. This is just something I think is exceptionally dumb in the edgy edgy conversation of this movie. Is he just the reason he drew that creepy picture is because he went back in time and wanted to be creepy for his worry his mum who he loves. He decides to draw this picture for no reason.
He went back in time, got told, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And that was adult Evan's answer to that.
Yeah.
And so he drew it. And then he gets up after finishing his picture, walks over to, like, you know, those things that you like stab receipts onto, essentially just a giant spike. There's two of those.
Not good things to have in a classroom, I thought.
But he says, "Oh, Mrs. Miller," or whatever her name is, and just like slams his hands down on them, piercing through.
Miller is actually the surname of Kaylee and Tommy.
Yeah, probably.
I think Mr. Miller is Eric Stoltz's character. Anyway, continue.
And yeah, slams them down, and then he reappears in prison with a cellmate, now having had these stigmata, the scars on his hands appear as if from the heavens, and it freaks him out. He's
much
like
cool. the concept of the butterfly effect.
And so he agrees to help him, and then. Goes into the Nazi cell and uses a bunch of racial slurs. And so break it down is that
several things wrong with it.
Yeah,
but
so he goes back in time. And so if he had done this as a kid, first of all, the scars would have always been there. They wouldn't have just appeared in front of this guy. But also the probably more important thing is that initially, in the first scene of the film, when he has been given his mum's been given the drawing that he did, he hadn't slammed his hands on those. And when did he draw the drawing? And made this small change, it should have made a big difference in his future. And he just wouldn't
be in prison.
Just
like how a butterfly flapping his wings.
Yeah. It's such a stupid, betrayal of everything the film stands for.
It also makes you question, what did he do in the regular timeline when he blacked out these times?
Yeah.
Because if in this one he stigmated his fucking little kid hands,
yeah.
Is that not, but he still drew the picture. So even if he wasn't going back in time to be creepy on purpose, he still drew the creepy picture, also for no reason. Why did he draw the creepy picture?
There's no
plot reason why he would have drawn that.
Talking about the various blackouts he has, that is one of my favorite ideas of the film, though. Mm-hmm. That we're talking about time travel and things. I love the idea of the closed loop time travel, where it's you've always traveled back in time, and so there's these moments of his life that he can't remember because in the future he travels back to those bits, and so adult Evan is experiencing it, taking over his consciousness. And it's not a perfect, it doesn't make perfect sense, but it's the same kind of time travel, I guess, that in a sense that the Harry Potter movies do, where it's like, you know, they're always there, or the example that's given is that you go back to investigate the cause of a fire and you inadvertently cause the fire. But yeah, I've always thought that was a cool idea, that it's like, he blacks out because he's been taken over, and because of the blackout, he knows that's a time that he can go back to because he wrote about the blackout.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, one thing I think is stupid about that plot hole, it's not part of the plot hole, is like the whole reason for him going back in time, for him stabbing his hands, for him drawing the creepy picture, was to convince his cellmate, who already likes him, to protect him. It's like, it's not even for a time travel reason that he does all this shit. It's to try and prove, falsely prove to this guy that he can stigmata. And also, can't you do something that's going to fucking hurt you less? Holy shit! Right? Yeah. If I'm going back in time to try and convince someone that I can time travel, I reckon I'm not stigmatizing my fucking hands. So that's all very stupid. One thing I also think is kind of guffed in this film as well is that the kid who plays young Evan, there's two kids, there's a 13-year-old
and a 7-year-old.
And like a 7-year-old, yeah. And the 7-year-old, they cast him, and that kid gets a lot of play. He's in a lot of scenes. Yeah. And he's
Logan
acting.
Logan Lerman, who would grow up to be.
Is that Logan Lerman, or is the 17-year-old
one? The 7-year-old one is Logan Lerman.
Okay. So I just think it's funny that they give that kid so much to do and say, right? And there are times when he's just playing 7-year-old Evan, and there are times when he's playing 24-year-old Evan having time traveled back, and he's swearing and he's foul mouthed and all these sorts of things. That kid, young Logan Lerman, how old was he here? Do we know?
So, what year did this film come out?
2004.
He was 12.
And it shows, because 12-year-olds don't look like 7-year-olds. So you've got this kid who's clearly 12, and then you're told very quickly that he's supposed to be 7, and you go, oh, okay, that's kind of weird. And then you see him swearing and shit as 24-year-old Evan, and it's like, yeah, the reason you fucking cast a 12-year-old is so it wasn't as problematic to have him acting like an adult, but like, they've split the difference too close to old. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, and also on top of that, 24-year-old Evan is not really depicted as being particularly badass or foul mouthed. So it's like the characterization of Evan when he travels back in time to his 7-year-old self is like this precocious, oh my god, imagine hearing a 7-year-old say this. But like, he's not like that in the present. So it's just a completely different version of the character. And I just think it's so silly and dumb. Like when he goes back and talks to his dad and he's like, okay, listen up, old man. And it's like, he doesn't talk like Ashton Kutcher's version of the character. Doesn't talk like this.
Yeah.
Ah, such a bad movie. So fun to talk about.
I loved it. I loved watching it.
Yeah.
I loved watching all three of these films. And this is the best one.
And this is easily
the best one.
I reckon that all the characters in this movie kind of suck.
Oh,
except
absolutely.
For one. There's one character who I want to see a whole movie about. No, close though. Similar, like, fame level to Eric Stoltz. I'm talking, of course, about Ethan Suplee's Thumper.
Oh, yeah.
The overweight goth roommate that he lives with in college sometimes, who is such a, like, there are characters.
What, his whole character is he has sex a lot, but he's fat.
Yeah. So there are characters, background characters in this movie who are so, like, just boring. Like, I would even say Amy Smart's Kaylee, very just kind of like, you know, it's male writers trying to write a way more concerned with the male characters than the female characters. And yet they could have easily made Evan's college roommate just a normal guy, but they made him such a specific vision. it's like, where is this dude going? Let's follow Thumper's butterfly effect, you know? Like, it's such a weird addition to the movie because it feels like such a, like, such care was taken in crafting that character. And for what? For what reason? He doesn't have closure. He doesn't have an arc. What I think it is that I bet in earlier drafts of the script, that character was supposed to be like Lenny. Who's the kid who gets traumatized. But he kept getting traumatized at all these storylines that they couldn't. So they have two characters that occupy that space.
Yeah, right.
One is the plot-relevant Lenny, and one is like, all right, let's just fucking make up a new character to give him some lines. And that could have been a nobody, but they cast Ethan Suplee and made him like a horny goth. It's incredible. It's great.
Yeah. Did you notice that one of the producers of this is called AJ Dix?
Yeah, I did, actually. I was going to take a photo of it and send you it. And be like, finally! So this is staggeringly, Richard, our first film franchise for both Ashton Kutcher and Amy Smart. We've never covered them before. Amy Smart especially, I would have thought, would have shown up in dozens of these. She's like only famous if you watch sequels, I feel like. however, the guy that plays Lenny is Alden Henson, or old version of Lenny, who people will know as Foggy from...
Foggy Nelson.
From, what's it called?
Daredevil.
This is his eighth film in film franchise Fortnite. So we've seen him before in Mockingjay Parts 1 and 2, all three Mighty Ducks films, Jaws the Revenge, and Dumb and Dumberer when Harry met Lloyd. Is where we've seen this guy before.
Just at a glance, looking at Amy Smart's filmography, I don't think she's ever done a sequel.
No, but she's in films that have sequels.
Oh, no, she's in both Crank films.
Yeah, there you go. She's in films that have the same kind of sequel that the Butterfly Effect have.
Yeah.
Richard, we've got a segment on the show that I think we should stop doing called Franchise, where we try to decide why this became a franchise. And usually the answer is money. And in this case, it's like there's no production notes on the sequels.
Yeah.
So I
do think with this one, though, that
I don't
know
why
the concept of the Butterfly Effect is such a good idea that it's like,
maybe that's all it is.
It's one, and it's a classic, like, we can just keep doing this idea and it's going to be interesting forever.
But is it? No. Do you have anything else you want to say about the Butterfly Effect one, or should we move on?
The one thing that like, and obviously they wouldn't have cast Eric Stoltz if he had gone through with being in Back to the Future, but part of me watching the film,
you make
was
it
like,
sound like he ducked out of Back to the Future off his own volition. Yeah.
But the
he was fired, baby.
But part of me couldn't help but wonder what an interesting thing it would be if Michael J. Fox had played that character.
Like, this film couldn't afford Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if the roles were reversed, Eric Stoltz,
Stuart Little's Michael J. Fox.
Yeah. That, like, Stuart, like, because when did Stuart Little 2 come out? Like, this is around the same time. That, like,
yeah,
imagine
2002?
That. Yeah, 2002? Yeah, the same year, or, like, you know, span of a couple of years, playing a crazy little mouse in a red convertible and a pedophile father. Like, that'd be fascinating.
You're right. Well, the butterfly. So you want to go back in time? Is it stopping Eric Stoltz from getting fired from Back to the Future?
Yeah.
So does that also mean that sort of cosmically, Michael J. Fox gets the role of Mr. Miller in the Butterfly Effect?
Yeah, yeah. And also, it would be in Pulp Fiction as well, I guess.
As the heroin dealer. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Richard, where were you? Everyone knows where they were when they. were in the warehouse and saw that the Butterfly Effect 2 existed on DVD. Do you remember when you became aware of the Butterfly Effect 2? Because it was a big deal for me.
Oh, really?
It was like, holy shit.
I can't say it was a big deal for me. I think I got this off Fatso, which was like New Zealand's answer to Netflix. Back in the day where you would get DVDs mailed to you.
I once had to write a commercial for Fatso.
I know, you've told the story many times.
Oh, okay. I'll cut that out then, please, Richard.
No,
person editing.
No. Tell us what was the commercial?
I don't think it ever made it to air, but we were commissioned to write something, and this was like 2015, but well past DVD's heyday. And the only idea I remember pitching that I thought was really funny was pitching it like DVDs were a new technology. And just seeing if they had a good enough sense of humor to run that commercial. But I don't remember what happened. The Butterfly Effect 2 came out in 2006. If we go to the Wikipedia page for this movie, it has up the top, for the episode of Ugly Betty, for the episode of Ugly Betty, see The Butterfly Effect Part 2, because the season 4 opening and second episode of Ugly Betty were called The Butterfly Effect Parts 1 and 2.
That's
I thought that was pretty funny. This was directed by John R. Leonetti, who is more well known as a cinematographer on film franchise Fortnite's films such as Child's Play 3, The Scorpion King, and The Mask, and he did go on to direct Annabelle, which we haven't covered for the podcast, but is a fairly high profile movie that he moved on to after this. What do you think this has on Rotten Tomatoes?
Like 27.
It has 27 audience score. It does not have a critic score.
Nice.
Holy shit. But that is still a big drop from the 81% audience score of the first film. What is The Butterfly Effect 2 about?
So this one is about a guy who, to set the scene for you.
Nick. His name is Nick.
Nick. And he is on holiday with his partner. It's her birthday, and they're like talking about their future, and then all of a sudden he gets called into work. So they leave, and
there's another couple with them as well.
On the way back, their tire bursts, they get into an accident, and the other three people in the car die, leaving Nick alive. Can I just say as well,
they try to be very coy with it, but it becomes very obvious that his girlfriend is pregnant and hasn't told. And you don't get told this till the end of the film.
Yeah.
But it's like, oh, fucking hell. Let's just reveal that she's pregnant.
So a year later, he's looking at a photo they took at the lake and travels back in time. But the first time he goes back and he's really just observing things and is like, what the hell's going on? But as he goes back and then he starts to, every time he looks at a photo, like the world starts to shake in the same way that it did for Evan when he would go back in time. And
there's a bit where he's like looking it up and sees articles about Evan's
Jason
father.
Treborn.
So making it set in the same. Oh my God, Jason Treborn. He was adjacent to Evan being reborn.
Yeah. And so he similar sort of thing. He goes back in time a few times to like make things not happen, to not have the car crash or to lessen the damage of it or whatever. And a lot of this one focuses more on his career progression. And his boss is a dick, and then he goes back one time, and now he's like the vice president, and his boss from the normal reality is now his subservient, and all this stuff. But reoccurring to this is that so Julie wanted to move to New York, and then when he's all successful, Julie didn't go to New York to pursue art or whatever, and so. There's tension in their relationship. And then he goes back again, and now he's all successful, and he's sleeping with his boss's daughter, and him and Julie have broken things off and quite bad. And then everything, you know, he goes back in time one last time and decides to fix everything by breaking up with Julie at the lake. And she says, well, I was pregnant, and this was a shock to him, even though she should have, like, they would have a kid.
No, because the baby died anyway in the car accident. And she talks in one of the alternate realities. She's like, you know what we lost in the crash? It's very, because all he does the first time is gets her to put her seatbelt on.
Yeah.
And skids out of the way. So they still crash. But
Right. Okay, that is flawless writing. So then he goes
back.
Hey,
it's better writing than the fucking racist prison scene from the first one.
But so he goes back in time again and breaks up with her. She takes his car, the one that's about to have a tire burst, and drives off. And he steals someone's car and drives chasing after her. And you're like, oh no, the tire's going to explode. That doesn't come up. The semi-truck is coming towards them, and they're driving alongside each other. So he's driving down the wrong side of the road, and he thinks to himself, oh, what I have to do is to fucking kill myself, I guess, and to make everything right. So he gets into the accident, and then it cuts to the future. She now has the kid. It's named Nick Jr., and it's implied that he has the same abilities as his dad. Because
to travel back to his dad's memories.
Yeah. So
let's see that movie.
He goes back in time to his dad's past
and has sex with his mum, becomes his own father.
The thing about this one is, so the time travel mechanic is different. He does it by looking at photos, but it's never explored because it ends up being that it's like, oh, his, you know, when he's successful, it's because he's fucking corrupt and like his whole business is corrupt and shit. But he never tries just going to New York with Julie. Like, these guys love each other. We're not shown enough that, like, his presence in her life is so toxic that they can never be together. It's just that, like, when he forced her to stay for his work, she slightly resented him for it. So he goes back in time and is like, right, we have nothing to do with each other. But it's like, you so easily could have made this work. Go back, replace your tire before it bursts, then realize, oh, I shouldn't be at this toxic environment. I want to be with Julie. Let's move to New York together so you can pursue your dream. Yeah. But instead he's like, no, I have to die. It's such a stupid ending.
But it's not just true of this film. My overwhelming thought watching all three of these movies, especially this one, is how easy it would be to stop everyone dying.
Yeah.
Because even if it's not the car crash, his like best friend gets beat up at a corporate deal gone wrong and all this sort of thing. But like, they go back to the holiday, fix your tire, or don't go to work. Don't get called in to work. An even more obvious solution. Mm. That one requires you doing nothing. like that one actually requires lack of action to listen, stop everyone from dying. You don't have to go to New York. You don't even have to give up your job necessarily if they're forgiving you for not coming in on a Sunday or whatever it is.
Well, the whole idea
just
is that
don't
it's like
go
he's
to
not
going to
get
work.
Promoted if he doesn't go to this meeting.
Right, but by this point, Nick knows that that's worth
The thing, that it's like, I can get, like, if you're writing a movie like this, it's not a good message to be like, no, the career is just as important or is more important than love. Mm. Like, no, you've written this film, you have to side with love.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but those are the rules. Like,
those are the rules.
And so, yeah, to not try and make the relationship work at the cost of your career, because also he's like in a tech startup, so it's like he's got transferable skills. He would find work in New York. I'm sorry, I guess it's not the Silicon Valley, but like it's such a stupid ending to the film because they want to have the same ending as the first one.
Yeah. So one of the other reasons he goes back in time is that in the future where everything's basically perfect for him and he's with whatever her name is, Johnny. but Trevor, his best friend who also died in the original timeline, he gets fired for this bad business deal and he's like, right, I'm quitting too. And it's like, that's the only thing wrong with this timeline is your friend got fired. And you know what's not as bad as being responsible for the deaths of your best friends? One of them getting fired. Stay in that timeline, Nick. What are you doing? Obviously stay in that one.
Well, even the one where he's very successful, but not with Julie, but he has very explicit sex with with his boss's daughter. It's so 2004 straight to video.
Oh, we're in the golden age of low budget film sex scenes in 2006.
Oh my god. And they just get more explicit as well.
Oh my god.
See nipple. When you think you're about to see nipple, you can see a little pasty on it.
I had seen this film before, shockingly, and can I just say, my mind is blown that I've watched it a second time in my entire life. Yeah, you know, like, I thought I would never ever even think about this film again.
Yeah.
So I'd seen it on DVD when it came out, but until rewatching it for this podcast, the only parts of the scene of the films that I had rewatched were the sex scenes.
Why is that, AJ?
Because I masturbated to them, Richard. But honestly, they are so explicit. But also, there's two sex scenes, and there's one when he changes things and he's back with Julie, and they have could very generously be described as like an intimate and beautiful sex scene where they're back together. Then he goes to another timeline where he's having a sordid affair with his boss's daughter or whoever it is. Mm. And it's so stupid because it's like, I get it, 2006. I get it. What's his name? John R. Leonetti. I get why what we have to do to make straight to DVD psychological thriller sequels sell. I know that we have to put sex scenes in them, but this one like betrays the character's integrity. If this was a movie about a guy wanting to get ahead in his job and using the butterfly effect to do so, sure. But it's not. This is a movie about a guy who is repeatedly trying to save the life of the woman he is in love with.
The father.
And you're telling telling me the mother of his child, and you're telling me that you felt it very natural to write into this that he has this crazy sex with his boss's daughter in this corporate bathroom.
In mild defense of that scene, I will say,
okay, so mildly defend it, please, Richard.
The two things about that scene that I'm like, okay, so one is that, like, in the middle of this, she pulls out a camera and is like, yeah, it'd be so hot. Like, let's take a photo while we're having sex. And I kind of liked that as a plot point, that it's like, he needs a photo in this timeline, so he has a point to go back to fix some things. And I kind of, you know, it's kind of funny, it's kind of kinky that it's like in the middle of a sex scene is the time he can travel back to.
But then they don't use that.
No, he does travel. He does travel back to it.
He tries to, but he gets knocked out before he can.
That's right, yeah. But the other thing about that is that what you're saying about, like, it betrays his character. I was thinking the same thing, but I was like, the one kind of, like, bit of writing that sort of saves it is that he gets that timeline's memories in his brain. So it's like, even though there is Nick in there as he is experiencing the film as we see it, there is also the part of him inside his brain that is like, I am having an affair with this woman. I have given up on Julie.
Is banging someone from an alternate timeline still cheating?
Yeah.
This is our third Eric Lively film for the podcast, wow, after American Pie and A Madea Christmas. And it's our fourth David James Lewis film after Child's Play 2019, Halloween Resurrection, and MVP Most Valuable Primate. I did not write down who David James Lewis plays in this film, so I cannot remember who he plays in this movie.
He's Dave Bristol.
Bristol.
He's the corporate
rival. Yeah.
Also, Trevor Eastman went on, he's so young in this film, but he went on to be quite a major character in Schitt's Creek.
Nice.
He plays Ted. And it's nice, after making that connection, very funny to see him so young.
The main reason I think this one is bad is how much it insists on being about Nick's boring ass job. So, like, the first one, for all its faults, is about, like, relationships and murder and crime, you know, like, it's very all feels like all the parts work to, but this one, they're in a startup where they've invented, like, a very 2006 version of cloud sharing a version of cloud sharing that isn't as interesting as what would eventually be made in real life. Yeah. And it's so funny to watch them, like, pitching these amazed investors, like, imagine you're going to a meeting and you get a message while you're in the car that you need to change a slide for the slideshow. Well, with your phone, you can do that. Which, first of all, that's finicky at best to do now. Change a slideshow.
It's like kind of pitching a smartphone. But it is funny, though, later on in the film, they're like, yeah, we're pitching, you know, a phone that can do this. And they're like, everyone's pitching that at the moment. Like, it's right on the cusp of the boom. It's actually not even that impressive at the time.
Yeah, and it reminded me of the bit we talked about in The Kissing Booth 3, yeah, where she just randomly pitches an e-sports thing, and she pitches a Kissing Booth video game, which is the obvious thing to do. And in this, it's like, they have put so much effort into describing what this, like, invention is, that it kind of feels like the screenwriters were like, this is a good idea. They should actually make this in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Richard, it's time for us to skedaddle on to the third film in this illustrious trilogy. I am, of course, talking about The Butterfly Effect 3 Revelations, released in 2009. Let's talk about how funny it is to give your film the subtitle Revelations when it's a standalone sequel.
Yeah, what's being like, revealed?
It's not Revelations about the whole franchise. It's Revelations pertaining to this film itself, which all the other ones also had.
So
this was directed by Seth Grossman, or Grossman, who does not have a Wikipedia page. Its audience score is slightly improved above the 27% of Butterfly Effect 2. Do you have any guesses? 32. No audience, no critic score, because no one was ever paid to watch this movie, I guess, is the reason for that. What is it about?
So I can tell you what this one's not about.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the concept of the butterfly effect. If you try and tell me, AJ, that this film was written as a butterfly effect sequel and wasn't an unrelated script with the name slapped on it, I'm going to punch you in the throat.
I'd like to see you try, buddy.
You're going to be here in a week.
Oh, my God. Okay, I'd never said it. I didn't say it.
It's like this. Do you know what this movie feels like?
What?
A Hellraiser sequel.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, this is a completely unrelated film that involves time travel that you could so easily have Pinhead show up at the end and just be like, I hope you've learned your lesson. Now come with me to the realm of pain. Or as we call, like, it's pleasure to us, but it'll be pain to you.
Right, yes.
As they always do. But this one is about a guy who travels back in time to witness murders and then tell the cops what he saw. And he says that he's a psychic. And in doing all this, he accidentally creates, he's tied to all of these murders now, which are unsolved. One of them being his girlfriend and then her sister and all these things. He keeps going back in time. And each time he comes back and something is slightly different, and he literally says, like, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah.
And I'd let me find the killer, who is named the Pontiac Killer, which is very funny if you watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine, because Craig Robinson's character is the Pontiac Bandit, and that name is said dozens of times in each episode that he appears, and so it's so distracting to have, like, the Pontiac Killer be taken so seriously. Also, never really explained why they call him the Pontiac Killer. Anyway, he keeps going back in time, more murders keep happening, he awakes in slightly different realities where he still has the same relationships with everyone.
That's the thing, and
his sister
helps him go back in time,
and she's a bit of a recluse, never really leaves the home, but we learn that he saved her life from a fire when they were younger, and she's always like, you never told me what happened during the fire. And then turns out, we find out later on in the film, that she died originally, and then when he went back in time to save her, it meant his parents dying. And then, yada yada yada, all these murders keep happening. It's at the end, it's revealed, spoilers for the Butterfly Effect 3 Revelations, that his sister is the murderer, and she's been going back in time because all these people, all these women, were actually people that he ended up with at some point. So one of them was actually, he remembers being a girlfriend. The rest were just unrelated because she went back in time and killed them before they could meet, because she's actually in love with him.
Her own brother. And then listeners, bear witness to maybe one of the most balls to the wall endings I've ever seen in a movie of this caliber.
Yeah, what happens?
So this is fucking crazy. You thought the ending to The Butterfly Effect had kind of strange messaging in it. You thought the ending to The Butterfly Effect 2 was trying to, like, ape that same sacrificial concept. You think, like, going back in time and killing yourself to prevent future misery is, like, the worst thing, a worst place a movie can go. This movie one-ups that, because this movie goes, let's go back and kill Hitler, theory, you know, in concept, where he goes back in time to that fire and actively holds her bedroom door shut while she desperately cries and pleads to be let out. This is her before she's a murderer, before she's a villain. He makes sure that she dies in the fire, and it is harrowing. If this was a well-acted film, it would be traumatizing to watch. Luckily, it's not.
Remember the Nightmare on Elm Street reboot, when they're, like, burning Freddy alive,
but
what's his name? Jackie O'Haley is the best actor in the film.
Yeah.
So it's like, when he's screaming for his life, it's like, let him out.
Yeah, like, it is such a nuts ending. I could not believe that was where they landed on. And
but then also it cuts to now present day. Sam, the main character, has a daughter named Jenna with Rebecca, who was murdered. And then the daughter just, like, has this doll and just puts it on a barbecue grill, watches it burn, and smiles.
Well, he named her after his sister, and it's implied that for some reason she's also evil, which very similar ending to the second one as well with the baby. So, look, it's interesting. You came at it from this was not supposed to be a Butterfly Effect film. I came at it from, like, this gets points for ambition.
This is not supposed to be a film.
No, no, not at all. No, I thought this was better than the second one because I was like, ah, that's an interesting, like, Butterfly Effect Incorporated, basically. Like, there is a
Butterfly
group,
Effect Presents.
Yeah, there is a group of people who can travel back in time and they get together and talk about it and talk about, you know, the rules and it's turned into like they call it Jumping, and it is kind of reminiscent of that movie Jumper. There's another time traveler in the film called Goldberg, who's another actor in the movie, and he acts as like a mentor, and that's exclusively his, like, the only reason he's in the film. But I did think that the Butterfly Effect Incorporated feels like something you or I would pitch for continue the franchise, you know?
Yeah,
but ultimately.
Well, I just think that it's like it's such a betrayal of the franchise to
it depends how much you care about. The ramifications thing is it should be called the Butterfly Effect 3 Ramifications. Ramifications would be a good subtitle for this.
Well, it's not about the ramifications. No, it's exactly, more about revelations than it is about ramifications.
It's true. Ultimately, I thought this got very lost in its own concept, and I was struggling to keep up with what they were actually talking about. But it became very clear, despite me being like, oh, this is an ambitious approach, it all falls apart as soon as the person Butterfly Affecting starts including other people in his operations. Because then you've got this confusing thing where it's like, he's gone to an alternate reality, but his sister's still his sister and she still helps him, and his Goldberg's still his mentor
Well, to be fair, he's going back to times after those relationships were established.
I guess so, but it's still like,
if we went back to before his sister was born.
But none of these characters seem to care that, like,
his relationship with the police is the big one.
Like,
every time he goes back, he has the same relationship with the detective.
But what I'm saying is, like, Goldberg from Timeline 2 is not upset that the version of Sam he's talking to is a completely new version of Sam.
There's a new version.
Like, he's lost the version he knows. And his sister doesn't care about this shit either.
Well, no, they haven't lost the version they know. The version that
I guess they've combined,
loses the version we know, we never see again. Yeah. As far as they're aware.
Because he tells them.
Because they merge and shit.
He tells them that he's from another timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like, did you jump again?
Yeah.
My point is that in order for this to work, in order to include more characters in on the concept itself has to be, like, dramatically weakened so that it makes sense that people would still know what's going on, you know?
One thing I will say in this film's defense, I like how far it went with the incest thing.
I did too, actually. I was like,
these things where if you're introducing this, you have to go as far as you did to justify it.
Yeah.
Like, you can't just be like, no, Sam, like, we're brother and sister, we're supposed to always be there for each other, and these girls were taking you away from me. And it's like, oh, are they implying that? No, it's like, no, she kisses him on the lips and he's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like, I'm in love with you.
Yeah.
We are meant to be together, and these girls were all trying to steal you. And it's like, yeah, that's where you need to go.
What, did you work out that she was the killer?
The whole time I was expecting it to be him.
Yeah.
And
but they
so I
say
was
that
like,
in the script, so I was like,
but they do. And so I was kind of like, it is one of those things. I wasn't surprised when it was revealed to be her, because it's like, there are three characters this can be because you haven't introduced that many characters. And so it has to be him, it has to be Goldberg, or it has to be the sister. And they tell you, oh, maybe it's him or Goldberg. So it's like, well, it has to be the sister then.
Yeah. Isn't it? This movie is so gratuitous compared to, like, this one feels like the Final Destination writers wrote
it.
Like,
well, and also this one has some, like, very, a much more explicit sex scene in it.
Yeah, that's true.
Which so gratuitous. So, like, unnecessary.
It's so gratuitous, listeners, that it makes you sad. From a 2023 perspective, it's like, oh, fuck, this is so...
is someone being exploited.
This is a very young, very pretty actress that is just completely
The call of her life
to
appear in a Butterfly Effect sequel, and what they're doing is slamming her titties on a glass table.
Oh, it is so depressing.
But that's the thing, that it's like you can do a film where the sexy bartender flirts with them and they have sex.
Mm.
That's fine. But it's like you don't need like a eight porn, different setups.
Yeah, a porn of porn them having movie sex. Style sex.
You can even have like what you know. It's 2006. It's a straight to DVD film. Sure, you can do the under the glass table shot. But it's like. Like, this is a day's worth of shooting of, like, different setups. And they thought, let's put them all in the film.
Yeah.
And also, oh my God, the way this film is shot and edited is so bad. there's, you know, the best I can, the most sort of mainstream thing I can think of is, like, you know, in Hot Fuzz, when, like, Angel is doing the paperwork and it's like it's deliberately shot, you know, it's a boring thing to look at, but the like, you know, like zooms in on little bits and like little bits float over other parts. It's like they are trying to do this in this film, but it is like how a film school student would do those shots. They are like, go back and watch them. It is so funny how like thinking they have the point it is. It's oh my God, they're so poorly done. Watching this film though. I enjoyed watching it. I had a great time watching it.
The film also opens with a mother being bludgeoned to death by a hit on her, and it's incredibly violent. One of the most violent things I've ever seen. She gets her head like caved in, and it's like the movie starts there with a woman having her head bashed in, and it's like this tells you kind of all you need to know about the where this movie's
going. One other scene that I did, I was kind of like, oh yeah, like is he. After realizing, like, oh, I can't save, you know, my partner, I'll go back and try to save the second victim. And so he sneaks into her apartment, watches her from the closet, and she's just going about her day. And then someone bursts in, and in a quite violent scene, begins to rape her, and she's screaming for her life. And then you're like, oh, wow, you know, we're about to see the killer. And then the guy takes
A straight-to-DVD rape scene. Just what I wanted to be watching tonight.
And then...
Not that a theatrical one is particularly... but I said this in my review.
I
want
to go to the
one.
Cinema to watch this. I want to see it on the big screen.
Like I said in my Letterboxd review for the first film, is like, this is not a good enough film to justify having a pretty detailed child molestation scene. Yeah. And it's one of these things where it's like, guys, if you're going to have these harrowing scenes of like the worst violence you could do to a person... You got to be really sure that the film is good enough to be able to be like, it need. Like, look at something like The Last Duel, which even then people were like, was that really necessary? If it's hardly necessary in Ridley Scott's The Last Duel, it's not going to be necessary in the Butterfly Effect 3 Revelations.
But what I was saying about that scene though is that like midway through this, as it's just about to get even worse, the master assailant pulls off his mask and is like, babe, I'm sorry, I can't do this. Like, and she's like, no, but like, I'm having fun, you know, I'm enjoying it. And he's like, yeah, but just like hearing you scream makes me go soft. And I was like, that was a fun subversion on where I thought that scene was going.
And to immediately backtrack and start praising this horrible moment in this film, pretty well performed, those two actors, I thought. And a movie full of like just dog shit, like Craigslist actors, and legitimately, they probably got like the cop characters were probably got off Craigslist, you know? It is this kind, I don't know. I thought those performances were actually pretty good. Anyway. Yeah, that's the Butterfly Effect 3. Terrible stuff, but I thought at least it was doing something different with the sequel, the third movie.
It's a good sleepover watch. Because worst case scenario, you see some boobies in it, but best case scenario, you have a good time laughing at this terrible film with your friends.
I like how you said you see some boobies in it, but and it's like boobies in it, comma, but, and you see boobies, but, yeah. So that is the Butterfly Effect trilogy, Richard. Do we want to talk now about Continue the Franchise, where we pitch?
Yes. What are the many continuations of the franchise we haven't looked at yet?
There is fuck all, dude. You type in the Butterfly Effect 4 into Google, it says movieclips.com, the Butterfly Effect, scene one out of four or whatever. Like it takes the four to mean just something. Like, even the sequels are so obscure that it's not even thinking you're talking about a sequel. No, there's nothing going on in the Butterfly Effect series that has laid dormant since 2009. I doubt there ever will be. I did have an idea, and I'm slightly... That's slightly been usurped now by this idea of a direct sequel to the second one, where a kid has the power to travel back to his dad's memories, where he realizes the only way to not prevent himself from being born is to have sex with his mum. I think that's pretty interesting.
Mm.
Would you
keeping the incestuous themes? The
yeah, but that
well?
That'd be a cool. That's a cool. Like, would you rather come to life? You know, he's in his dad's body, so he has his dad's semen and dad's sperm, and in order to make sure he is not never born, he has to have sex with his own mum. That's a great idea for a movie. I'm going to write that movie. It's going to be called The Butterfly Erect. No, I do have a better, and actually pretty, I think pretty good Continue the Franchise to pitch you. I was thinking about, like, especially inspired by the third one and the fact that it's like this operation now, and that there's these rules to this universe and stuff. And I thought, like, what about like a Grand Theft Auto style video game, like about the criminal underbelly of some city, where you have butterfly effect time travel. And so this is like an expansive, like revolutionary new game map, where it's not a map of geography, it's a map of time. And so you're playing the game and you have the ability to go back in time to when your character was younger, and you change something, and whatever you change, the ramifications then exist when you flash back to the present. You know, and like really going like, so like there are thousands of possibilities.
It's like,
you know?
No Man's Sky.
A little bit like No Man's Sky, but with time instead of space. Do you think that's an interesting idea?
Yeah. I think it couldn't exist.
You don't think it's possible? You don't think we're there yet?
No, God, no. God, no.
Well, it's something to shoot for then.
Yeah, shoot for the moon.
What's your continue the franchise?
My, like, I think we can have another go at the butterfly. I think that,
guys,
that you
hear
can
me
make
out.
This work. I think that there is a way to make this concept work. And I think the things I'm fascinated by are like, one, the idea of like alternate realities. What if I'd never done this? But I also love the like people going mad, essentially being like, I can make everything work. You know, it's like no matter what happens, you go back and something is always going to go wrong, because especially if there's this idea that like there are moments in life that are fated to happen no matter what you go back and change. And I love the idea of like, you know, people being driven mad because it's like, no, I can make everything work. And actually the idea I had, which I remembered that during the third one, I was like, this is a good idea. Remember this. And I completely forgot it until now. But I think that if you remake a Butterfly Effect, and this could be a TV show actually, because it already is a TV show, and what I'm pitching is the show True Calling. the second season of True Calling. If you haven't seen True Calling, it was great when I was a kid. I don't know if it holds up, but it's this woman who works at a morgue played by Eliza Dushku, and
the amount of fucking times you've told me what True Calling is about on this podcast over the years.
I'm pretty sure this is the first time I've ever brought up
No,
True
it is not. But you talk about True Calling all the time.
Bring up one clip. Bring up one
You're
clip
the editor.
Of me talking
it's
about
your
True
responsibility
Calling.
Now.
No, I'm if anyone can find an episode where I've brought up True Calling, I'll send you a patch. And okay. I'll actually do it. I'm not going to send Dave his that I owe him. I will, Dave, at some point. Anyway, But the thing that's interesting, so yeah, she works at a morgue. The dead bodies come to life and say, "Help me." And she relives the previous day and has to save that person's life. Mm-hmm. Anywho, in the second season of the show, Jason Priestley is introduced as a character. I can't remember the guy's name, but he also relives the day, but he has to ensure the person dies. So it's essentially like, one's working for good, one is working for evil, or one's like, you know, essentially his character is just ensuring that the timeline goes ahead as it's supposed to. And there's one day where they relive, but they get the other person's vision. So it's like True has to make the person stay dead. Anyway, I think the idea of two people butterfly affecting, and it's one person's job to ensure everything stays the same.
Mm. Nice. I'm really compelled by what you said about, like, you know, it drives you mad, butterfly affecting. You know, it drives you insane, and there's always going to be something you can't change. And I actually think that revelation, no pun intended, is the revelation that the writers of the original film did not have about what the film should be about. Ashton Kutcher's The Butterfly Effect should be a film about accepting where you are in life. Because that way, if you make it about if you try to change things, you will go mad, you can have the baby suicide ending. And the message of the film is like, look where it will get you. You know what I mean? Whereas this version...
That's kind of the plot of Everything Everywhere All at Once, right? That it's like being introduced to all these different versions of yourself, and they're all quote-unquote successful when you aren't, and having to find success in where you are.
Yeah, nice. Richard, we have got to rank The Butterfly Effect.
It's such a good idea for a film. It makes me so
We have got to rank The Butterfly Effect amongst the 184 franchises we've ever covered. And
A Gold Star franchise?
No, I don't think so. I think that the straight-to-DVD-ness of it all is very apparent in the sequels. Yeah. I think they...
Is there a clear worst one, though?
I would say the second one is the clear worst one. I don't think it's not your favorite. I'm pitching you that we place this at 161, between above the Yu-Gi-Oh movies, but beneath the Cinderella Story movies. What do you reckon about that? Yes, no? You usually hate this segment, but now it feels like you're taking this very seriously.
It's like, I don't know, because I do enjoy watching, like...
The franchise, bro. The franchise, not the...
Well, that's the thing, about, like, yeah. Because it's one of those things that it's like, if I was tasked with, like, you have to rewatch one of these, like, taking length out of the equation, I would so much sooner rather rewatch these films than... the Connery Bond films.
Yeah, but they're just not... It's not as good of a franchise as the Connery Bond films. I mean,
well,
I think... So above a Cinderella Story,
well,
we've got the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movies, then 101 Dalmatians, Bad Moms, Boondock Saints, Santa Paws, From Dusk Till Dawn. I think by the time we get to From Dusk Till Dawn, we're absolutely... It's not better than Dusk Till Dawn, you know? I'm happy to adjust it if you like, but yeah, so 161 you're happy with?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we could be here adjusting till dawn.
Referencing the wrong franchise. sweet. Okay, well, that is where we have ranked the Butterfly Effect trilogy, Richard. There's only one thing we need to do now, and that's reveal what the next franchise is. It is supposed to be Spooktober. We got behind on episodes, thus making Spooktober kind of forgotten this year. But we have asked the patrons to suggest some spooky franchises.
I think we've remembered Spooktober.
We can at least have one spooky franchise.
I think the Butterfly Effect fits.
I was terrified.
Butterfly Effect 3... Revelations on Wikipedia is called an American science fiction horror thriller.
Easy. Done. Sorted.
If we can't include science fiction horror thrillers in Spooktober, AJ, I don't want to do the fucking podcast, all right?
Alrighty. So Now we're gonna reveal what the patrons have voted for our next franchise, which we'll be covering in 2 weeks. If you want to get in on this and start suggesting which franchises we watch as well, you can do this over at patreon.com/ColePopture. Richard, if you're able to reveal what has won after I do the little pluggies, I would just like to say that if people enjoyed listening to this episode, then please consider subscribing at all the places. You can find us wherever you're listening to this right now. You can also follow us on Instagram and Twitter at ColePopture. Sorry, X, not Twitter. And you can also jump on our Discord and chat all things Butterfly Effect with us this week on the Disky. And yeah, as just said, if you want to join the Patreon, you can do that as well at patreon.com/ColePopture, where people have told us our next franchise for Spooktober. Richard, tell me what it is.
Next franchise we will be covering is one that it feels long overdue in a lot of ways. We are going to be covering the 8 films in the Leprechaun franchise, which just beat out the Exorcist franchise on the Patreon vote.
Leprechaun. Honestly, we should have done this for a St. Patrick's Day episode, guys.
Yeah, you dumb fucks.
I know nothing. I know that one of them's called In the Hood.
And then Back to the Hood.
And Back to the Hood. It's all, and Warwick Davis, that's all I know about this franchise.
And In Space.
And In Space. We're finally getting an In Space franchise. It's actually in the title. So stay tuned for that fun episode. I hope people watch along with that one, because I don't know how much people are going to understand if we watch 8 movies that they haven't seen.
Yeah.
When did this podcast get to the point where you need to have watched the franchise to follow along with us, do you reckon? Do you reckon we hit that point years ago, or is it still...
No, I like to think that we still, you know, you don't need to listen to watch. Nice. You don't need to listen.
Well, thank you so much for listening if you did, and we will see you next fortnight for the Leprechaun series. And if you stick around for the post-credit scene, or just coming at you after this music ends, you may hear a little question or thing that is asked or suggested by you, the listener. Happy Halloween, everybody, and whatever you do, do not go back in time and change something small. Just observe. That's the only safe way.
Yeah.
Welcome along to the post-credit scene. There's a segment at the end of each episode. If you donate $5 or more over at patreon.com/ColePopture, you, get to give us something to talk about in this, the post-credit scene. Richard, who is it from this week?
Today's one comes to us from Michael Prefontaine, who says, if you were a cartoonish evil villain, where would your base be and what would it look like? What would your henchmen / henchwoman wear as uniforms?
Mine would be a rotating, like, you know those rotating restaurants that are like top of skylines? Be like that sort of thing, but in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Mm. And all my henchmen...
And it rotates... vertically.
The wrong way, yeah. And all my henchmen would wear denim overalls.
Nice.
And nothing else.
Yeah, I think you're describing the Minions.
and I'm Gru.
Yeah. My base, I wouldn't want anything too high up because I don't like heights. I feel like I would just go for like a place that I would like to hang out. Like it would be like a movie theater or something, or like, oh, it's an escape room, but you have to solve puzzles to get in. And I'm the most intelligent person on the planet, so I'm the only person intelligent enough to solve the puzzles to get in.
What you've actually just described as like the level leading up to a boss in a video game.
Yeah. And I'm the boss.
Yeah.
And my henchman / henchwoman would wear like ammo that and health crates that drop when you kill them. And then I attack you in just like a pattern.
And you would also like, in, you know, you say like no one's smart enough to get further deep into this fortress. Mm. But what you've done is you've actually left crates of ammo and health where no one has been.
Just
in case you end up there one day.
Well, yeah, and once you get past the wall, that's like no one has breached this wall in centuries.
Yeah.
There's some of my henchmen there.
Yeah.
Imagine Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.